go to here.
Oh.
Whoops. I'm going to do the headless wire set. Record.
What's that?
Oh, Tim, do you want to post PowerPoints and stuff to Canvas, or do you want to put them on a website?
I'm going to use Canvas because that's what I've usually used. So.
Okay, and see if the echoes are too large. I don't know if they're going to be too big or not. Okay, so we won't worry about this thing. Okay,
all right. Sorry, man. It took me 25 minutes to go 5 miles this morning.
Oh, goodness gracious. No, it's good. Perfect time. All right. So let's go ahead and get going. So welcome to Monday. You know, I know it's a stressful day already. Right, starts off stressful. But with what's such a wonderful class, we'll get your week going right? Muscle physiology. Remember, next Monday, we're having a special class on the holiday. No, I'm joking. Okay. So next Monday, remember, you're off next Monday. Do not come to class. And we do have class on Wednesday. I'm hoping on next Wednesday that we might have a primary paper that we can kind of go over on muscle development. And I think that's kind of interesting as well. We'll talk with Tim about that. Maybe a couple papers we can talk about and give it to you this Wednesday so you have a week to look over it, all right? So the idea today is to go through Chapter 1, kind of cover the general basics of muscle physiology for some of you. This might be a review and, you know, sip on your coffee or whatever you need to do in the meantime. But it's really quite interesting, so hopefully this refreshes some of the memories that you had. So this is being recorded on Echo 360. I don't know how much Canvas can handle on the web, on, you know, content. We'll see if they can put it all up there. And then it's also on a podcast, so we have a podcast too, in case that's out there. So remember, we encourage you to get your textbook, but if not, at least you're going to have all the PowerPoints that will be posted up on Canvas. And if you need anything else, then just let us know and we can make some copies or make sure that you've of content that we didn't have or put it in PowerPoint, all right? So hopefully that will help with that. Any questions that you have? All right, so let's go over some general muscle physiology, and hopefully, and also, since you have other courses or maybe information that you've had in the clinics or if you're working in the clinics, bring that, you know, forward to the class, too. That would be really interesting to discuss, or if you found an interesting topic that you want to talk about, that would be great, right? And as you will see in the textbook, if you're reading through the text, some of that content's a little bit dated, and some of the changing ideas that are occurring, right? And so with the primary lectures that you'll get later on in the course from other people like Sharp Peterson or Esther DuPont Van Steeden, they might have a little alteration in some of that content, especially like stem cells and satellite cells and how they work as well. Let's go through a little bit about muscle development. It's really quite interesting. We start off as myoblasts, right? And then those myoblasts fuse together, and we have this syncytium, kind of, depending on which muscles that we're talking about. And then they start to fuse, and I think we maybe all know that skeletal muscle is multinucleated because of the fusion of these individual myoblasts that come together. And then you might see the satellite cells in those muscles. And you find a primary myotube, the one that will be larger than the secondary myotube that's usually packed together with these two. And you'll see in developing or regenerating muscle, as well as in developing muscle, these nuclei are centrally located. And there's some interest as they begin to form and develop, and then the wrapping that goes around these muscle cells, beginning muscle fibers, then you will start to see these satellite cells move around inside of this on top of the muscle, but you see the nuclei will move from a central nuclei to the peripheral. And then this is a mature muscle cell, which you'll see with the nuclei to the side and satellite cells around these muscle fibers. And remember, the satellite cells are outside the basal lamina, or inside the basal lamina, but outside of the plasma membrane of the muscle cell itself. So that's one of the definitions with these. And when these satellite cells get inside of the underneath the muscle fiber, that's when they can divide and actually add to that muscle fiber in development. So kind of interesting. Let's look at some of the muscle and dividing it up. And there's different ways that we'll look at this. This isn't in your textbook. It's presented in different ways in your textbook. But just remember the units of the muscle, skeletal muscle. So we look at the muscle, as we just went through, the embryonic muscle, they fuse together, make myotubes, and those myotubes, multinucleated, make muscle fibers. And remember, a muscle fiber is a single cell, right? So it's a single cell. So muscle fibers, if we start to break up those muscle fibers and you look at them, then you have a myofibril, and those are as thin as your hair, right? Very thin, small diameter. And we can look at the myofibril, and then we have the banding pattern inside of the myofibril, which is the contractile element. So we do want to know the general anatomy of skeletal muscle, and the best way to study for that, like Tim was saying, you know, blank piece of paper, right? Because you have an open response kind of regurgitation, if you will, but not just regurgitation of content, but knowledge, right? So we should be able to draw a sarcomere and understand the general anatomy of a sarcomere. The best idea, really, to understand the sarcomere and the banding pattern is to draw three sarcomeres in a row, and I'll tell you why in a little bit. It helps you out with understanding the banding pattern. But let's look at this banding pattern also, and you can see this, and this is why it's called striated muscle. That's the whole reason it's called striation, because it's striated, and it has to do with those individual contractile units, myofibril. So let's go through some of this and break it down a bit and understand the different units there. So different parts of this are named because of the way that light actually penetrates these bands that we see in here. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. So just different ways to look at that. Remember, a sarcomere is this one unit in the myofibril, and it goes from Z-disc to Z-disc. And so we will look at what's between that Z-disc and what goes across the Z-disc for banding patterns as we look at these general anatomy of the muscle fiber. So let's see what we got here. So hopefully this will help a little bit to see what's inside of these and banding pattern. How this came about is really quite unusual. I mean, when you think about it, back in the time, to understand how muscle contracted, they took sections across there. And you think about really being clever about when you took a section across the muscle fiber and you saw this kind of arrangement, and you took a section through the muscle fiber and you saw a different arrangement, they had to conceptualize the three-dimensional structure of the muscle fiber. So it was really by sectioning muscle fibers at different points along the contractile unit that they actually pulled this together to try to get the anatomy. So it's quite interesting, intriguing history to this, and actually then even disassociating the muscle with visceral, and then watching some of these units come back together, like the myosin units would come back together. And they began to pull it all together to understand the anatomy of the muscle fiber. And then after they knew the anatomy, and tried to build models with it, then they began to understand what happens when muscle contracts, because that anatomy would change a little bit when they go through the sections or looking at it with light. So then that, they came up with the idea of the sliding filament hypothesis. And now it's called sliding filament theory because now it's been proven so many different ways in different animals as well. So let's go through a little bit of this and understand what's inside this unit. Okay, so if we take myosin itself, and there's different names of the myosin, which we'll go more in depth later, but this myosin unit is really quite interesting. They can form together, as I mentioned, after you disassociate them. You put them in the dish, they'll actually reform together and make these kind of globular units together, basically like the myosin that's found inside the muscle itself. And hopefully the paper that we'll cover next Wednesday helps to bring together how muscle actually is develops. And some of the best work in actually understanding muscle formation, how you develop a contractile unit. I mean, think about this, like if you're exercising, right? You have muscle and you exercise, you build up the individual muscle fibers inside, right? The contractile element inside, that builds, that adds together. But you're building that while you're exercising, right? It's not like it's not being used. You actually have to build that unit, that contractile unit, inside that muscle fiber that's already there, so your muscle fiber gets bigger. And then with issues like atrophy, that muscle fiber atrophies, but it's still contracting. That's phenomenal when you think about all this connected together, how it could build and then degenerate or regress inside of a functional unit at the same time. So some of the work that has actually been looked at with this is actually in the Drosophila skeletal muscle. And why that has been a model is because it's just easy to do, to mark different proteins and actually see how they're assembled and disassembled. Okay, so the tail of the myosin and head of myosin, and we know that these are two that wrap together, the helix, to form this myosin unit. And I think Ken has a lecture later on, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and he will go through probably a lot of the individual physics of the angles of those myosin heads that are different on the muscle and how they connect with the actin as we go along, so I won't go too in-depth with that. Desmin is actually very important. This actually helps hold these individual units together, these sarcomeres are from Z-disc to Z-disc. And you can actually see right here in the Z-disc, you have a lot of desmin. This is a molecule that actually helps anchor these sarcomeres together and keeps them from pulling apart, even the myofibrils themselves. So let's look at this, and you can... So if we go to these banding patterns right here, the A band, and the H band, and the I band, your text does a good job about explaining why they're named this way. Does anybody remember why the A band? Why is it given the name A band? No idea. Really quite amazed. Quite neat. Let me find that for you. Just so we... So that you can make a little note too. If you go to page 15, or at least in your text, page 15, that gives the reason why they're named this way. A band is this, if I pronounce it right, this anisotropic, which means that if you shine light at it at different angles, it gives a different kind of image. So by shining light at this, they actually saw it a little bit differently. Where the isotropic is this I band, which doesn't matter which way you shine light at it, you have the same kind of image. So that's why they named these the two different ways. And H band, anybody? A German for hella, light, so it was a light band, and you can see this light band inside of this part right here, and then the Z disc, because it looks like a Z, actually. And in some animals, and we'll go through what's in these different bands, you can actually see a very nice Z disc. You can actually see it going back and forth, and some muscle fibers, like a real Z, because, and then if you just looked at that, if you took, say, an animal from Mars, if we found any up there, and you did the histology, and you saw this Z disc that really went back and forth, and you took another muscle from this animal, and you looked at the Z disc, and it didn't have such a Z pattern, what might you think about the differences in these two muscles? Now, maybe I put that question too early. So let's go through some of the structure that's inside of these of this band pattern, and then just think about that in the meantime. Okay. So what's inside of this structure? And I wanted to go over this M line as well. In some textbooks, this is actually a little confusing with the H zone, just to make sure that we understand this. This M line is where those myosin, so here's your myosin, the A band from end to end, the myosin. And this H zone is where actin, coming from the Z disc that are attached to the Z disc, this actin is coming in the end of the actin filaments here, okay? So that's your H zone. So the end of the actin, like my thumbs are the Z disc, and the actin's coming together like this. The myosin is the whole A band. And then this, so this H zone is from the end of the actin to the end of the actin units here. This M line is the middle of the myosin, where those myosin heads, if I go back two slides or so, this M line is right down the middle of this myosin, where you see it going
the opposite direction.
In some textbooks, it actually shows the H band looking like it's the M line, but just to help clarify that then. Okay. All right. So this is the myosin, the actin, the H zone, the N line is right up the middle of the myosin, and then we have the Z disc. And why I said to draw three sarcomeres to try to understand the banding pattern is you see the I band goes across the Z disc from the edge of the myosin to the edge of the myosin on the next sarcomere. So it goes across the Z disc. So when you're labeling your bands, it's better to draw three sarcomeres to understand that. So if the myosin with the little heads, as we'll come back to understand how it contracts, but the myosin has these heads, right? And it attaches to the actin, so it can pull the actin together. So if the actin's being pulled in both directions during muscle contraction, the sarcomere can shorten, right? But does the A band shorten during muscle contraction? Not at all, right? Because the myosin heads are pulling together like that. So the I band will shorten during that phase. Right? And does the H zone change muscle contraction? If that's the end of the two actins coming together, right? And the N line won't change, and the Z disc will show, but you'll actually see it come together. So some of the early work that they were looking at with that was just shining light on it and actually seeing the Z disc move together. And then they could fix the tissue, section it, and begin to put together that 3D anatomy of the contractile element. And this is how they came up with the sliding filament hypothesis, that the muscles sliding over each other of these bands. We will talk about it in the next, on Wednesday, more about energy dynamics and how that's utilized, but we can see the glycogen granules here in the muscle, basically in that T-tubule region. Okay, so we want to understand generally about the sarcomere and its banding pattern. If we look at it in a live preparation like this, it's in your text, you take that individual cell and you can see the banding pattern, and then measure the distance between those, say, with contraction. Now, Ken Campbell has a really nice setup in his lab. Hopefully we can go over there someday and see it. He shines light on his preparation. Anybody work in Ken's lab? No one? Okay, so he shines light on this and he actually projects it up onto the wall so it can be expanded out. And then on the wall, he has his increments marked on the wall so he can actually look at how much this sarcomere is shortening. And that way it accentuates the distance so you can actually get better measurements. I think it's really a clever idea. So that's really quite neat. We will talk about different types of muscle and the sarcomere distances between the Z-disc to Z-disc, the sarcomere lengths are actually different in different types of muscle. And so we'll go over that later as we go along as well. All right. So if we take a cross-section, if you saw cross-sections of skeletal muscle, and hopefully we'll get to do that later on in the class and actually see these on slides, stained up muscle fibers, you can then understand that kind of array that one would have, right? So if you take it through the myosin inactin, then you can see the actin makes this nice ring around each myosin. And Ken Campbell has really put into a lot of computational programming about how these myosin heads bind to the actin and at the different arrangements that they have. So a lot of anatomy has gone on into understanding the myosin heads interacting with the actin around there and how many heads bind to the actin at one time and all that kind of good work. Took a section right through there, we just have the myosin. We take a section through here, we just have the actin. So you can get the idea of how they pulled this together in the history of muscle anatomy. Okay, so try to remember your banding pattern. Blank piece of paper is the easiest way to go with that and see if you can remember how to label this. And this is where I was mentioning about sometimes that H band and people get confused on it. With that M line, you see how this could be confusing a bit with the M line. And if you but think of the H from the end of the actin to the end of the actin here, just like fingers on your Z disc, right? And remember that Desmond is the unit that helps hold these together a bit more for structure. And from the end of one myofibril to the other. So let's go through a little bit about what's on these individual units. So the actin is really two strands of actin that's together, and it coils around each other. I think of a rope, two big ropes, like ship ropes, and you line them up and then you twist them. All right. So that could be the actin. And then you think about tropomyosin, a smaller molecule here that's in structure, and it goes around the groove of the actin. So think about taking two pieces of yarn together and twisting that, and then laying that between the two ropes and having that going through the grooves of those two ropes that you twist. So that might help you get the anatomy down. So tropomyosin, we call this tropomyosin vertebrates pretty much, and then some invertebrates are called as paramyosin, so you might see this being explained as paramyosin when you're reading comparative textbooks, for example. So it's a type of, it's the same kind of idea, tropomyosin. And then the troponin complex, and you see that there's different parts to this troponin complex. We have one type of troponin that actually interacts with the tropomyosin. So what kind of troponin is that called? Troponin T is a tropomyosin. And then we have two types of troponin C and I. C, troponin C, that binds calcium. So we can remember that, C for calcium. Troponin T, the troponin that interacts with the tropomyosin. And then troponin I is referred to as inhibitory. So troponin I that inhibits the interaction. Okay, so maybe that'll help try to remember these different types of troponin that are in there. We'll go through more of that as we go along. You don't have to remember, at least for me, I don't think we have to in this course, remember exact, you know. Now maybe Ken will get a little bit more involved and tell you, know a little bit more about this, but for our purposes, for my purpose at least, I don't want you to have to memorize numbers, but just a general idea. So we have these, as we mentioned, these coiled alpha helix of the myosin, units of two myosins that are coming together, making that kind of alpha helix here. And then you have these myosin heads, and then these myosin light chains that are on the head itself. Right? So these head regions, they can actually break these off and see this is where you have ATPase activity, myosin ATPase, and actually in these regions too that you can run it on a gel, and you'll actually have different types of myosin heads that will have different banding patterns or different molecular weights, and actually different activity of the myosin ATPase as well. So different muscle will have different activity of the myosin ATPase, the way it can break down ATP, and you'll have different isoforms of the myosin light chains as well in muscle. So you'll hear about that more as we go along. And that you can break it apart, like with trypsin, and people didn't run those on the gels. Anybody doing any of that in their labs? No one's doing any of that? Okay, so that's kind of interesting, because then you can run these on gels, depending on different types of muscles, or even on a comparative aspect, and you'll see different banding patterns. And that helps, early on, that helped actually classify different types of skeletal muscle, because you saw different banding patterns, like fast muscle and slow muscle, if you want to use those broad terms. Are in different kinds of species of animals that have skeletal muscle. And so they'll actually go down on the gel at different distances based on the molecular weight. Okay, so the idea is that you can break up muscle and get it into the different units and understand it. Nowadays, you know, a lot more antibody staining that can be used on these different protein units and different isoforms as well. So we already mentioned that you can disassociate myosin and you can put it back in the dish. And this is really quite interesting. So early times, this is what people did, and it actually helped them to understand how that unit might come together, the myosin unit itself. Okay, so I wanted to go through a little bit about, anybody heard of Albert St. George before? No? Albert St. George, phenomenal guy. So he actually escaped the war time. And let me just see what we have here. I think there was something I read that was really quite interesting about Albert St. George. Well, he got the Nobel Prize for vitamin C, if I remember right. Right? Didn't he get the vitamin C Nobel Prize? Yes, physiology Nobel Prize in 1937 for discovering vitamin C. Who else got the Nobel Prize for vitamin C? 2 Nobel Prizes in vitamin C. Isn't that amazing? Anybody remember the other guy? No one remember? Okay, well, we'll go through that. That's kind of neat. All right, so here's an old picture. It looks like Dracula. It looks like some Frankenstein movie, doesn't it? Old times. But he was one that he worked at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. Anybody gets a chance to look at summer courses, undergraduates as well as graduate students. Applications are usually in early on, and I really encourage you to look at these kind of programs. When I was a graduate student, I was applying every year to go to MBL, to go to a neurobiology course that was there. And I kept applying. I know this is a full tangent. You'll get used to tangents, so I should go home. And I was really frustrated. You know, you put in your application, there's only 10 slots for this particular course, internationally competitive. You know, one semester after another, rejection. We're sorry. And then there was a meeting, a neuroscience meeting, Society for Neuroscience meeting. And it was the one year they held it in Toronto, Canada. They can't hold it up there anymore because the meeting's too big for the city, actually, which is unreal. It's 30,000 people this year that are going to the neuroscience meeting for 5 days. It's ungodly. But anyways, went to this meeting, went to go talk to a person. I was waiting for an interview, actually, for my postdoc. I'd written to this person. This is before, you know, emails, okay? You had to actually write a letter, mail it, stamp it. And it was for this guy that was working in Switzerland. And he said, well, are you going to the neuroscience meeting? And then he called one day, and I was like, oh, God, he's calling. You know, and we had to actually use phones back then to call, you know. And then so we called back and forth, and he said, well, okay, then why don't we meet at this day, this time, meet by this publisher's booth, because he was signing books. And I said, okay, so I'll find this, you know, place. And I was there early, you know, nervous as could be for the postdoc interview. And while I was sitting at this table, I noticed this poster, and I had been reading this guy's work, it was C.K. Govine, and he actually worked at a Marine Biological Laboratory. I was like, oh, God, he's working there. Maybe I can get him in somehow, you know, talk to him about this course, how do people get to this? But I'm already graduating, so I never had a chance, you know, to get to this class. And so I talked to him about his poster, and he was working on crustaceans and wonderful animals. And he was working on lobsters and regeneration of lobster claws and the sensory input into the animal, as well as he was interested in muscle, too. So I proposed him. I said, well, have you looked at this? And I read his papers as a graduate student. I was interested in his comparative physiology. And I was just kind of happy to meet him, for one thing. So really get out and go to meetings, because you see the PIs presenting at meetings. You get to meet them, potentially postdocs. And I proposed this project. I said, well, have you looked at these proprioceptors in the limbs of the lobster as it regenerates? And do they lay all the proprioceptors back in right away with the regeneration? Are they continually adding them as that limb grows out? And he said, well, you know, we haven't looked at that. And it would be really interesting to address that question. Would you be interested in doing that? I said, well, that'd be great, but I'm interviewing for this postdoc and everything. And he said, well, if you would be interested in doing that, I'll pay you to come to Woods Hole for the summer. And I was just like, what? You know, I've been trying to get this for 5 years nearly. And he said, but that would be kind of a stipulation, because we're at a lot of money for this. They have to pay a lot of money for their lab space there. And he said, well, I'll pay for everything, and, you know, if you come and work for the whole 4 months, because I got the lab space for 4 months. I said, well, this sounds great. And then I hear this person behind me saying, oh, hi, CK. This fellow stood me up. He was supposed to meet me at this time. And I turned around. Oh, my God. It's the guy I'm supposed to be interviewing with. I completely forgot that I was supposed to be interviewing because I was so engaged with this guy at the poster. And then I said, oh, that's me that I was waiting for. I knew you were right there because I was just right here by the poster and I could see the table, you know. He said, well, I've been over there for 5 minutes. And he was really, you know, chop, chop kind of guy. And so I said, okay, you know, here. And then so we sat down and chit-chatted. And just to make a long story short, this is too much tangents. Then we sat down and talked with this guy. And he said, well, why do you want to work in my lab? And I proposed projects of why I wanted to work in his lab. And he said, that's really good. I just interviewed 2 other postdocs, and they basically said why they wanted to work in my lab, and none of them proposed any kind of research projects or why they have a passion to work on that particular project. So he said, I have one condition. If you want to come to Switzerland and for a postdoc, is that at least you come for 3 years. And I said, that sounds good. And he said, so you want to work on that project? I said, yeah, that would be really super if that's possible. He said, okay, then forget any other interviews. You're going to come to Switzerland. But I said, well, CK just offered me a summer job kind of for Woods Hole, and I'd really like to go. He said, oh, that's perfect. I'm teaching a neurobiology course at Woods Hole this summer, so why don't you just come and kind of sit in the neurobiology course? I was curious, you know. So at that time, I had to find a payphone quickly. I didn't have cell phones back then. I called my wife back home. I said, guess what? We're going to go to Woods Hole for the summer. CK's going to pay for our room for the whole summer. He said, bring you too, because he knew that you did illustration, biological illustration, and he wanted to do some artwork for his lab. And then we're going to move to Switzerland. So my wife's response, have you been drinking? So it was quite good. The point, the take-home here of this is get out and meet people, go to meetings, go to posters, but also apply to these workshops, right? And these courses, these are international. You're going to meet people that you can make friends with for the rest of your life. And it's really important to get out there and talk to people, all right? And so don't be discouraged. You never know what might happen. Be ready to go. At any point, you can always be on your best, you know, presenting. Anyways, sorry about that tangent. So he worked at MBL, which is really one of the oldest marine biological laboratories in the United States. And it's over 100 years old. And lots of people, when I went there for that summer, just to let you know, MBL for the summer, you meet kind of in a cafeteria. And I met over 4 Nobel laureates there during that summer because they're teaching. I sat down one time for breakfast. I was eating my Cheerios. And this person comes up next to me and says, do you mind if I share a table with you and talk to you? And I looked up and said, no. And I'm eating my cereal. And there it was, Eric Kandel. He got the Nobel Prize. And I was just kind of like spilling it out of my mouth like I had some disease or something. So, but he continued to chit-chat with me. So it was really fun. So the idea is to get out and do things. So he was at MBL. The reason I bring this up is in the 1950s, when electron microscopy just became really being used, he already was looking at skeletal muscle. And he really did quite a bit of work. He had a lot of problems with this, you know, getting funding for his work. But he went on and then he was taken on to NIH, to actually work at NIH. And then he became quite a recognized person. But he was the one that actually looked on the biophysics of muscle movement. And he found out that muscles contain actin, and when combined with the myosin, that the energy of ATP was used to actually allow muscles to contract. So he was early on in understanding that ATP was necessary for muscles to contract. But he doesn't get the recognition that he should, because he actually helped to put together the sliding filament hypothesis and identify the different types of proteins that are in muscle. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of the history with that. And your text doesn't mention too much about Albert St. George, so a little bit about that. So we've just talked about the contractile element, and I'm showing you different slides to help you in different ways to look at this. Other terminology that's used, a thick filament for myosin and a thin filament for actin. It's thinner and thicker with the myosin. So remember, the myosin heads come off of the myosin like this in both directions, and they pull the actin together. So what you see here is the contraction of the sarcomere from C-disc to Z-line, or C-disc or Z-line, and then how that contracts and which units come together. So the A-band doesn't change, but you see the other bands do change, right? Because the actin's coming together, and the end of the units from one side to the other, like we were talking about before, the I bands, from myosin to myosin, you can see that getting shorter as well. So this is quite interesting, because then we can think about the force that this generates as we have more myosin heads overlapping, right, with the actin. So we're getting just a few myosin heads, like a few here, for example, but now you have more myosin heads that can attach with the actin. So the idea is what? You're generating more force, because you have more contact, more interactions with the actin. So it's like a tug-of-war rope, right? You put a few people on the rope, you can measure force in the middle, then you add more people, and you add more people, you know, the tug-of-war, basically, and then ending up with more. But as you add more and more people, what happens? These tug-of-wars, like when you're going to see those sororities and fraternities playing out in the grass, and you see that mayhem that's out there, and you see a whole bunch of people on top of it, and you see the whole thing just kind of fall apart, right? It gets too many people interacting. So when there's really a lot of interaction and overlap here, you start to lose the force that can be developed. So we'll go through that as we look at the graphs. Something interesting while I'm showing this figure here you see that the actin is actually overlapping with the actin from the other side, right? So this causes this interaction, this problem with the number of myosin heads that are going to bind, right? You're going to start to lose the number of myosin heads that can bind. Some muscle, not the vertebrate muscle, but some muscle, particularly in barnacles, I know it's comparative, we're not barnacles, but to understand how our skeletal muscle works, a lot of comparative biology has come together to look at understanding how our muscles work. And barnacles, they are super contracting muscles. They actually have the ability to take these light bands as actin, and they contract so much that the actin unit goes through the Z-disc. It actually has holes in the Z-disc. They can super contract. And so they actually contract so much the sarcomere becomes super short. And so that's really quite interesting. But then people are looking at, well, how can they do this and then have any force develop? So they have a different arrangement of some of the myosin heads around the actin. And it doesn't lose force, but it can have super contraction. So it's really quite interesting on a comparative aspect to look at different types of muscle fibers and the limits that they have in their abilities. So now we can begin to understand this tension in just relative terms here. And this is a general graph on this point. So if you look at the sarcomere length, like we just talked about, and let's look at the tension that can develop. So if we overstretch muscle, if we really have it stretched out, we have very few myosin heads interacting with the actin, right? So it's a little force. We'll see we have passive force, but this is the amount of tension that can develop with this. So if we started to stimulate this, and we'll talk about the process of that, we don't have very much tension that can develop. But as more myosin heads overlap with the actin, so we should draw a bunch of heads here. I don't like this figure totally. You could draw in more heads if you want to on here. Then you have the greater ability to generate more tension, right? This is kind of interesting. Even though we shortened the sarcomere a little bit, we really haven't changed the tension at all. Any ideas about what's going on there? What's happening? Well, remember that M line, kind of, where the myosin heads are going out both directions, like that, and there's nothing in the middle? So as the actin comes closer together, there's really no more myosin heads that are interacting. It's maxed out, really. But it can still shorten a little bit. So that's that plateau region that we see here. And then as we stimulate more and have more contraction, then we start to lose that tension because of that inhibition of those myosin heads and actually taking away some of the contact sites on that actin. And then in some cases, but it's kind of experimental cases that we can get this super contraction that happens. So physiological range, Tim, wouldn't you say it's kind of around this area right here? This is the physiological range for our muscles. And here, this we don't really see unless you overstretched and you damaged your muscles or experimentally in the labs. If you're doing that, you overstretch it, you might damage it. And then you might not even get a good curve when it does contract because you've damaged some of the, not only the myosin, the interaction, but actually there may be even the Z-disc part of it. And we don't really see this kind of super contraction in physiological terms. But experimentally, you can induce it. So, kind of think about that and what's going on. So this would be a nice graph to try to redraw for yourself, too, and understanding that contractile elements and the ability to generate tension. And this is really important later on when you think about how much tension you can develop at different lengths of your muscle, for example, your biceps, if you're lifting a weight way out here versus lifting a weight halfway up, and Tim will probably talk about more of those dynamics, versus if you're trying to lift a weight and the muscle's already fully contracted, how much more tension can you develop, how much more weight can you lift, or the rate of being able to move those muscles, right? The velocity of movement. So a lot of work has been done not only stimulating the motor nerve, which has some contributions to understanding it all as well, but stimulating the muscle directly. And the reason is you can get rid of the nervous system and synaptic transmission and just look directly at the muscle itself for contraction. So you can bypass some of the delays or some of the issues with the neural transmission that goes on to skeletal muscle. So then if later on in the class, probably Ken Campbell will be talking about the muscle that he works with, and actually not, you know, they're devoid of the nerve. I love the nerves, but actually to understand some of the muscle abilities, you want to get rid of that variable and just look at the muscle itself. And actually not even worrying about depolarizing the muscle directly, but looking at how calcium interacts with that muscle, and not worrying about calcium flowing into the muscle. And what they do is they permeabilize the membrane and pick this up and move it to a different bath, for example, one with high calcium, or pick this up and move it to another bath with low calcium, and seeing how the muscle contracts just by changing the calcium or the ATP along with the calcium without directly electrically stimulating it. Okay, so you can get rid of the electrical component and just look at directly the, say, the calcium and the ATP process and muscle contraction, which we'll talk more about. Or you could electrically stimulate it to the muscle directly and look at the effect of depolarizing the muscle and then the process of muscle contraction. Or one could stimulate the nerve that goes to the muscle and then look at the force of muscle contraction, right? And all those experiments have different kinds of questions that somebody might be asking, but there's different ways to get muscle to contract. So when you're reading the primary papers, sometimes it can be a little confusing, because they don't talk about synaptic delay, maybe, or they're not talking about the depolarization of the muscle, but they might be working with permeabilized muscle that has holes in it, so calcium can actually get right into the contractile elements. So kind of pay attention about the way the experimental designs are set up to understand how they might be addressing muscle tension. All right, so if we look at this generally kind of graph, it's not anything specific right here, it's just general. If you look at normal muscle, you put that and you hold on it, you can see the tension that develops. So without stimulating it, without, you know, contraction, as you pull on the muscle, one can see this passive tension that develops, right? So you got proteins that are there. We have the C-disc, we have the actin, we have the myosin between. Not only that, we have the plasma membrane, right? And then we have all that matrix that's around the muscle. And we have some units inside the muscle that we're going to talk about that actually help keep the Z-disc from just ripping apart, called, what's the largest protein in your body? Titin, right? And it helps hold those, the idea is holds the myosin to the Z-disc, and so that can contribute to passive tension as well. So there's lots of aspects that can seem to contribute to this passive tension. So if you pull that muscle fiber, the more you pull it, then you're going to get some of the passive tension, or tension from passive stretch. And then if we have the contraction, we're stimulating this, and you actually have myosin heads overlapping and contraction, then you can see the force that you develop from this overtension that you develop from contracting that muscle. So people look at these graphs. You can subtract out the passive tension, and then look at just the graph for the contraction of the muscle itself. And we'll talk more about that as we go along in the class also. But just to get you an idea of the contractile element and the tension that it develops, and part of the reasons why we have this passive tension. So we just went through this pretty much on tension and the shorting chains that come out through that with the myosin heads that overlap. I know I'm hitting it more and more, and have enough of that problem by now. But then here's the titin that's inside, and you'll see in the primary literature actually different diagrams. This is one of the better diagrams. But we've had a number of lectures over the years in the muscle group that actually people have worked on this. What was her name from Nikasaga from Arizona? She came and actually talked about this. I'm probably mispronouncing the last name. But she actually works on titin and in different muscles. And she showed different diagrams for titin that actually interacts with the myosin. So let's just go through this again. Here's the membrane, right? Here's the myosin unit. And you can see the titin attaching to the myosin and then to the Z-disc. So if you're stretching this, this protein is really quite strong. And it's the largest protein in your body. Actually, it wasn't described until quite later compared to the other proteins that were actually identified. It didn't run down on the gel, really. It stayed up at the top of the gel in a lot of those early experiments. And they didn't see the banding pattern of it until later when people started to address what is that band standing up at the top on the gel. And they found that it was pretty much tight. So they have different diagrams of time. When you look this up, even on Wikipedia, you'll see differences in the structures of these. Some of them show like a coil and actually going to the actin. Some of them have two little coils in there, and they're still trying to figure out the exact anatomy of how Titan works, but generally it's thought that it has some kind of elasticity to it to give it some elasticity, right? So it can stretch out, but also come together and not just blob up here and interact and cause problems of the myosin head binding with the actin, which we'll talk more about, but it needs to kind of coil up and get out of the way. So the way that the structure is coming out, that might have these coils that can stretch out and then come back together like a spring and actually allow these myosin units to overlap with the actin without inhibiting the interaction. So there's really a couple models that are out there about how Titan itself is connected in with the Z-disc and with actin and with myosin. But it adds to that passive tension that we've been talking about. All right. So Titan, largest molecule. Anything else about Titan? Anybody covered that in some other classes? All right, you covered it. Anybody see the seminars from last year? Or you're all newbies and not been here forever? Okay, but they're really quite interesting. So let's look at some of the other proteins that are for this muscle. And so we've covered, you know, the general ones that we're always familiar with: myosin, actin, myosin heads, right? Myosin tails, Titan. But when you start to run it on a gel, there's many bands that start to appear, right? And you wonder, what are all those other proteins involved? And this is not in your text too much, but it just kind of opened up our eyes to many, the complexity with skeletal muscles. So if we look at the plasma membrane here, there's a lot of proteins that are in the plasma membrane that help to anchor that contractile element inside of the muscle. One of them, you've probably heard of dystrophin, right? So dystrophin is another protein that helps in the anchoring of that contractile element on with the plasma membrane. Remember, the cell, the plasma membrane, it's just not a bag of that fluid inside there and the contractile elements. It all has to be structured, right? And you don't want to break the plasma membrane either, right? Damage the plasma membrane, because then ions will flow in and you won't have any control of contraction that we'll be talking about. So all that has to kind of be all put in place as well. And if think about, I don't want you to memorize all these things, but just to understand that there's proteins that are going across the membrane, and what's not shown here are ion channels too, right? Voltage-gated ion channels, other types of channels, sodium-potassium, the pumps, the sodium-potassium pump, right, is inside this plasma membrane too. So a lot of proteins in this plasma membrane, and I don't think we have to go through the bilipid membrane too much, but remember it's bilipid membrane, you know, from both directions. Phospholipids and the tails, but all these proteins together in here interacting with the internal structure of the contractile element, dystrophin, you know, muscular dystrophy, right? The dystrophin complex, you can have different breaks in the dystrophin to give rise to different types of muscular dystrophy, but then that dystrophin that binds to these integral proteins, and then the matrix that's outside of the muscle. So all these proteins with the matrix that's outside the muscle. And what's going on here is this helps join these myofibrils together, and even the muscle unit with the fascia that's around the muscle, that's all a basal lamina matrix that's in here. And so this is really quite interesting because there's a lot of other proteins, look at collagen, for example, fibrin, different types of collagen. So when we're talking about even the passive tension that we were talking about with Titan, think about all this is in there too and interacting. So this is contributing in aspects to that passive tension. So don't try to memorize, but just kind of appreciate that there's a lot more to the muscle and actually even outside of the plasma membrane that is contributing to different disease processes or problems with muscle. And even as an aspect we'll talk a little bit later on about the nerve that innervates this plasma membrane. Remember, why does the nerve come to a particular region in the muscle, like the belly of the muscle in us, in mammals? And then the communication from the muscle to the nerve, and the nerve to the muscle. So it's thought that agrin is actually a molecule that can be secreted from the nerve that can interact with the muscle, but that the muscle actually has a factor that can be released from the muscle back to the nerve that actually then communicates to the nerve and says, you know, we have enough of innervation and we're going to keep this nerve there, for example. And so it's agrin. Agrinitin is a molecule that comes out of the muscle and interacts with the nerve. So a lot of dynamics that goes on between the nerve and the muscle on top of all this complex. And it's even interesting now, and I think Esther DuPont Van Steeden will talk about it later on, about exomes. Vesicles that are inside of the muscle that look like a bilip, has a bilip to it, and then it can fuse this membrane and actually be released from this muscle. It's actually the bilip that comes off of this muscle, and these little vesicle packets can diffuse away and get into your bloodstream. And so she'll talk about that. She actually isolates these exomes. Anybody working on Esther's lab? DuPont? No? Okay. And so she's isolated these exomes. It's a big fact, big thing right now, because then that can go to other other tissues in your body, right? It's a bilipid. And then that can fuse to other tissues and actually communicate to other tissues. So if muscle's active, then you have different types of maybe exomes that are in the circulation and could then relate to other tissues and might have some consequences that a lot of people are beginning to address. So let's just think about that. So the bilipid membrane making a vesicle that can then go off into the outside of the cell and then take it up in a capillary, for example, and then into the bloodstream. And that little vesicle can go to other muscle or maybe go to other tissues and have some kind of response. When they found that, that was really novel. It changed everybody's thoughts. Then they started to look at, do other tissues have exomes? Does the liver have exomes? They find different things. Does the kidney? And then people started looking at the nervous system, and they even found the brain has exomes. So it's a whole other way of communication, right? Completely different than what people have thought for many years. So it's really quite interesting, but it was actually easier to look at in skeletal muscle, and probably because we have so much muscle mass, right? That makes up the major contribution of us, and so you can actually find more exomes than you could from muscle than you could from the nervous system or other ones when you start to look at it. So it's really quite neat. So let's look at just a little bit about this dystrophin complex, and I think maybe later in the class somebody might talk more about the disease process, or maybe one of the students wants to use that for their presentation, and you could think about the different types of muscular dystrophy and where what happens with muscular dystrophy and this dystrophin complex. And if we have an altered dystrophin complex, that's all we're going to think about what would happen to the muscles. If you had an altered dystrophin complex, and think about this binding to, say, the Z disc and the contractile elements. So do you think if you had a breaks in the system, do you think you would have stronger muscles or weaker muscles? Weaker muscles, right? So this is the whole idea, and this is the problem with muscular dystrophy. And we think of that basal lamina, which is basal lamina outside of the cell of the muscle fiber, and that interacting with the dystrophin complex, then we're not going to have strong muscles. We're going to be weak, floppy type of muscles, right? So this is the idea with this dystrophin complex. It's interacting with the plasma membrane, which then interacts with the contractile elements inside of the muscle. So the take-home here is not to try to memorize all these different proteins, but the general idea is that you have proteins that interact with the plasma lamina outside, right? This matrix, glycoproteins, with the plasma membrane, and then the plasma membrane interacting with proteins that are inside the cell to that contractile element that we talked about, and then all the proteins that we just talked about with the contractile element themselves. Okay, so if we look at muscle, you know, we did take a cross-section here again, just to kind of re-emphasize that. You can see the muscle units here going around, and we also see something over here. What is this? This is nerves that are innervating onto that muscle. So even on that passive tension, if you had the whole unit, this could contribute to that as well, right? You've got nerves, you've got all that matrix that's around the nerves, and not just the fascia that's around the muscle as well, but you've got a lot of other proteins that are there. If we look at a muscle that's atrophied, tissues atrophy, look at these muscle units here, and then you can start to see that they shrink quite a bit. And those are a preparation that's actually atrophied tremendously, and issues atrophy actually in a crustacean preparation. So it's kind of interesting to think about how much that can change at NISR at the same mag, how much that can change over time of disuse atrophy. So just a little bit more about some terminology with muscle tension. So you've probably heard about isometric and isotonic contraction, right? If you're in the therapy program or in some of those courses. So if we started to think about picking up a weight, right? Picking up a weight off the ground, this is the way I kind of generally think about it. Picking up a weight off the ground that's too heavy to pick up. So you're trying to shorten, but you're not actually shortening the muscle much, right? Because you can't pick the weight up. So this is the same length. You're developing the tension, but you're not actually shortening the muscle much. So isometric contraction, right? Versus now maybe someone's yelling at you behind, or finally the Red Bull's kicking in, and you could actually get enough to contract. And so you're actually shortening that muscle, but the tension, the weight hasn't changed, right? It's the same weight. So isotonic contraction. And it's kind of interesting because you get a different tension curve from this than if you're starting to shorten it and holding it there, and then you can relax it. So fatigue, well, I might as well talk a little bit about that. As we're getting through this kind of contraction, anybody understand what fatigue is, muscle fatigue? Let's think about bodybuilding. Anybody? Somebody's bodybuilding here, right? So you get fatigue, you hit the wall, right? What is fatigue? How would you define fatigue? What's the mechanism behind fatigue? Have you ever talked about that in another class? So what's fatigue?
Calcium problem.
Maybe a calcium problem? So the calcium in the nerve terminal or calcium in the muscle problem?
Could be both,
all right? So maybe there's a calcium problem in the sense that maybe low calcium and you're getting tired and you can't really do it, right? And, you know, versus hitting the wall, right? You run that marathon, you really hit the wall and your muscles are just jello and you can't move at all no matter what happens, right? So but if you're just lifting weights or you're running, like we did this weekend with Ken, my muscles are so sore from it. I bike, but I don't jog. So it's been like 3 years since I've jogged. Like fragment of my life is going on. and so I was getting fatigued there. But then, you know, you see these youngins that are jogging along and you think, okay, I can do it. And so you think about fatigue. Is it really at the muscle level? Is it at the nerve level? Or is it something else? Is it really biochemically? Are you running out of ATP? That's what generally people think, right? Energy stores. But then think about this. So you're running, and you're fatigued, you're tired, and you just can't run anymore. And then your drill sergeant behind you yells at you, you lazy bum, get up and keep running, right? Or electric prog is, you know, shocking you. You can run again, right? Because you don't want to be shocked anymore or yelled at. So was it really the biochemical lack of ATP? Right? So fatigue has a lot of psychological component to it in the whole animal. But when you talk about fatigue at the muscle that's isolated, that's a different ball game again, right? So when you think about fatigue that people look at with these kind of experiments and they see, say the muscle's fatiguing with repetitive stimulation, for example, we'll think, are they stimulating the nerve? Is it an animal holding onto a bar? You know, things of the whole animal versus the isolated muscle cell as well. So this causes some confusion sometimes when people are looking at primary articles and understanding what fatigue is. So in the whole animal, like an us, or if you're working with patients, it's a psychological component, it's a major factor as well, versus if you took electrodes and put it into their muscle and kept stimulating it, you could probably still get that muscle to stimulate, right? Because it's not really the lack of total ATP in there. Now, if somebody hits the wall from some marathon, and you try to probably stimulate their muscles, I bet it wouldn't generate as much force because they probably used up a lot of their energy sources as well. So in definition of how you want to define fatigue, experimental paradigms that one uses. And it is a little confusing in primary papers sometimes. When I was earlier on reading these, I was always confused until it kind of dawned on me and somebody pointed out, well, it depends on this experiment. I was like, oh, the light bulb went on. So I said, why didn't anybody ever tell me that? You know, maybe they just assumed. Smart enough to figure it out, but it wasn't. All right. So, and like what we talked about velocity of movement too, and how much you can actually the rate of movement, for example, so you can look at Gmax. If you didn't have any weight lifting on your arm, right, you could generally move it pretty quick. But as you're adding more and more weight to that bell bar, how fast can you move that muscle, right? So the velocity, as you're adding that weight, finally the weight's so heavy, you can't pick it up anymore, right? So you're not moving it anymore, the length's not changing, right, with the heavy weight. And so that's the general idea here. As we increase that weight, the velocity is dropping, and then you can't move it as much as you would want to because it's just too much weight. I'm sure Tim will talk more about that with muscle dynamics. Right? Maybe.
Yeah, we will.
Okay. So let's go through a little bit of this. 8:30. Right. Okay. About muscle contraction. Now we're down to the individual unit of the myosin and actin interacting. And think about taking away the other aspects of the muscle, like the nerve and depolarization down the nerve terminal. Let's just work with like a permeabilized muscle. All right? So we're just dealing with that muscle. Let's look at tension. And let's add ATP to the bath. Nothing happens. Add ATP, nothing happens. Add ATP and calcium to the bath. Now what happens? Get tension developed. Take calcium away, and what happens? The muscle relaxes. ATP could still be present in the muscle. As you add more calcium to the bath, you can get more force up to a certain level to max it out, right? Reach a plateau. So how does this work? What's going on with this? Well, it goes back to these units that we've been talking about, like troponin I, C, and T. Remember T for tropomyosin, C for what? Calcium, right? And that's T that interweaves inside of that tropomyosin, which then interweaves inside the actin, and that's the unit. So as calcium comes in, binds through troponin C, what does it do? It causes a conformational change. Like in biology, most things, they function by a conformational change in the protein level. So a conformational change changes, exposes what we call the active site on actin, right? So as calcium binds through, the active site is exposed, and the myosin head is just waiting. It's just waiting to bind. But it can't bind when that troponin complex is in the way, so it's inhibited. But as soon as it moves out of the way, myosin head binds and just ratchets forward, so then it's going to start to contract. So the calcium's important to then cause that conformational change so the myosin head can move. But then what gets the myosin head off of the actin? ATP is dependent process, right? So we'll see as we go along. We've already shown this, but this is kind of interesting too, that the ATPase activity for the ATP that's generated for the myosin head to come off is actually calcium dependent. And there are papers that actually have shown that the troponin C has a cooperativity to binding calcium. Now, I don't know, I'm going to have to look it up. I just don't know how many, if it's a, it must be more than a 1-to-1 binding with troponin C and calcium. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to start to look at that because I've actually saw this paper. I just saw the headline, the title of the paper. It said cooperativity of troponin C with calcium. That means there must be more than one binding site of calcium on troponin C, which makes a whole different ballgame. So we'll try to find out the answer for that as well, and maybe somebody knows. Oh my God, this power supply. I did plug in my power supply. No, I didn't plug in my power supply. There we go. We're saved. And that's one if you pulled that before I left. Yeah. Okay. So the other point that we want to understand here at this point is that if you add the ATP with calcium present, remember we can get muscle force. ATP removed doesn't relax yet, right? So it's still contracted. But as soon as we take away that calcium, does it relax? No. But as soon as we add the ATP back in, now we get relaxation. So these were the early experiments to try to understand, like when Albert St. George was working, to try to understand how ATP was necessary with muscle contraction. And it takes that ATP to actually get that myosin head off, so if you're pulling on it, then it can relax, right? And it can come back down. But the calcium is necessary for exposing that active site. So I know that might be a little confusing, but if you kind of think through it, it makes sense in that aspect. And if you use And we could do that. We can actually get the rabbit muscle. I think it's really nice. You can order it from Sigma. And you can put permeabilized rabbit muscle in a bath. And you can put it in different baths while we look at it in a microscope. And we can actually then have the bath with calcium present and with calcium in ATP or without calcium in ATP. And you can actually watch it change. And so it's really quite neat. And you just do it one time and you can actually see this. So we've taken that to schools and actually done this in high schools. It's quite fun. Okay. Now we've still got some time. So let's just think a little bit about the other aspect about muscle and what causes it to contract, right? Well, the other important tissue in our body, the nervous system, which we won't go in depth in this class, but it's my little baby, too. So the nerve, action potential comes down the nerve, right? What happens at the nerve terminal? What's special about the nerve terminal? When the action potential, sodium goes in, potassium comes out, the nerve terminal is depolarized. What happens at the nerve terminal? What's a special type of channel that's in the nerve terminal? Besides sodium potassium for the action potential? What's another ion? Zinc, magnesium, calcium? Calcium? Calcium comes in the nerve terminal, and that causes the vesicles to fuse to the membrane, release the transmitter. If we're talking about us, mammals, acetylcholine is a transmitter, right? So acetylcholine in the side of these vesicles fuses, it releases the acetylcholine transmitter onto the muscle fiber. Then those receptors, they're nicotinic on us, right? The type of receptor that we have, the nicotinic, because nicotine will activate them, so we call it nicotinic. And then that causes the depolarization. These nicotinic receptors are actually ion channels. So when acetylcholine binds to that, it becomes an ion channel. It opens up. Sodium goes in. Some potassium goes out. That depolarizes the membrane. So you depolarize that membrane, and we'll talk about what happens in here. But it can depolarize that membrane and then relate to muscle contraction, right? So acetylcholine receptors at the neuromuscular junction skeletal muscle, we call those nicotinic receptors, right? But not all nerves to muscles are nicotinic, right? If we talk about the sympathetic and parasympathetic system, and we're talking about smooth muscle, which is a different ballgame, then we can actually have different types of receptors at the nerve to muscle interaction. But you might hear muscarinic receptors and nicotinic receptors, but for our purposes in skeletal muscle, nicotinic receptors. Now I know we're mammalian centric in here and human centric, but just to remind you, and we get this problem all the time in the psych class, they teach our undergraduates a little bit off things. They say all neuromuscular junctions are cholinergic, acetylcholine, right? Cholinergic. And that's how muscles contract. But we have to step that back. Humans aren't all only animals on this planet. You just look at the number of beetle species, just the number of beetle species alone, there are more beetle species than all other animals on this planet, right? So it's really interesting. And what transmitter is used at the neuromuscular junction in most invertebrates? Now, there are some invertebrates that use acetylcholine, but the majority of invertebrates use glutamate as the neurotransmitter. So actually, the majority of neuromuscular junctions use glutamate if you look out through the whole animal kingdom, right? And understanding muscle contraction, a lot of our understanding of muscle contraction came from looking at locust and crayfish crustacean preparations, actually. Why? Because those preparations live very well in a standard media, just saline, at room temperature. You didn't have to keep the temperature worried. You didn't have to worry about running down. You can keep a cockroach preparation going for hours, 6 hours or longer, and it would still function very well at room temperature. So a lot of our understanding of even the dynamics and variability, like fast and slow muscle, comes from a lot of the invertebrate work early on, and then they looked at mammalian preparations and made parallels to it. So some of that history, we should kind of understand some of it. Anyways, then, in that muscle fiber, if we stuck an electrode in that muscle fiber, you can actually see that the action potential on the muscle fiber is generated, and then later, the muscle contracts and we build up tension. So first, that means that we need electrical depolarization of this muscle fiber to develop the tension. So how does this process come about?
In mammalian systems, usually this innervation is right in the belly of the muscle fiber. So right in the belly of the muscle fiber. And then the action potential travels both directions on the muscle fiber to then build up tension. And the idea is that we have some pretty long muscles in our body. So the action potential that can travel very quickly down this muscle can cause relatively a uniform type of contraction, right, at the same time. So that's kind of an important process for developing the tension throughout. And we'll talk more about the process involved. But when people were beginning to study this and how this could work, it was some of the early experiments. They took an electrode with potassium in there, and they could spurt out potassium. And if they moved it across the muscle fiber, they actually found that when they had a little localized potassium right by where the Z disc goes down, they got the local contraction. And if they moved it over in between the Z disc, they didn't see that kind of contraction. So there's something very unique about around the Z disc. And if you look at the plasma membrane, this is where the T-tubule forms. This is where the plasma membrane dives down into the muscle. So they could find out, hey, there's something unique about the T-tubule region. We can actually induce little muscle contractions right there. And then they understood more about the more we depolarize that muscle fiber, with these type of experiments, you could generate more tension. So it was related with muscle depolarization to the tension that could develop. Okay, so this is the idea of the Z-disc, that you could get these little contractile local contractions going on. And there's something very unique about that region. And that region is, let's see.
Okay, almost there.
That depolarization in these T-tubules, like a T, right? That's what's called T-tubule, triad. And that caused this local muscle to contract. Now let's go through some of that process about how that actually works. So you can see again that T-tubule region right there, right here. And it runs down right by the Z-disc. And then this is inside the cell now, right? So the idea is that this is inside the cell. This is the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside the cell. You can see a nice picture here. And how does all this work? So here's another view of it, a cross-section, the T-tubule, and the Z-disc, the T-tubule, and then inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside a single cell. And they could actually look at this in different ways, how calcium is related with muscle contraction. But you can also look at very fine muscle contraction by looking at the light, photodetection. This is actually used in multiple ways, not only to look at the sarcomere shortening, you can pick this up, but you can actually use calcium indicators inside of a muscle cell. So when calcium is increased inside of the cytoplasm, you can actually look at a change in the imaging, the emission spectrum. If you're exciting these indicators, you can look at the emission spectrum and see how much calcium is being inside of the cytoplasm by looking at the fluorescent, the change in excitation of that particular protein. So different ways that they can actually look at this and understand the relationship with calcium and muscle force. So let's look at this for example. Here's the action potential. And if you use some kind of calcium indicator that you can actually measure the cytoplasmic calcium that rises with the depolarization, you can see the calcium goes up. And then force will be generated. So that's kind of really neat, the relationship. And it's all, you know, down these T-tubules for depolarization. And what happens down these T-tubules? So we've got the T-tubule. Going down the T-tubule, there are these proteins, and I know they're named crazy, but this dihydropyridine receptor is a voltage detector. It can detect the voltage, the change in the action potential that comes down, and this dihydropyridine receptor changes its conformation. The idea, and the text actually mentions that these can be calcium channels, but actually we had a seminar last year by a guy in Ohio that said probably under physiological conditions, calcium really doesn't come through the dihydropyridine receptors, but it still acts as its voltage sensor. So it detects the voltage, changes its conformation again. Remember in biology, lots of conformation changes. And then it's connected to this other protein on the inside of the cell. Inside of the cell, these are the ranitidine receptors. And they're named because of the pharmacology that binds these particular proteins. The ranitidine receptors are connected to the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside the cell. So think of a bathtub.
And inside of that bathtub's all the calcium. And now you just pull the plug, right? And what's going to happen? All that calcium is going to rush out. So think of the ranitidine receptors as that plug. It's plugged up. And as soon as you pull that plug, right, by that depolarization from the dihydropyridine receptors, pulling that plug, now calcium dumps out into the bath. And what's going to happen when calcium dumps out? It's going to bind to what? Troponin C. Troponin C is going to do what? Change the conformation. Expose what? The active site. Myosin's waiting. Myosin binds, ratchets forward. The myosin doesn't come off unless ATP is around. Then the ATP is around. Let's cleave. We'll talk about that. The heads can come off. If there's still active sites around, right, then it can ratchet again. Ratchet again, ratchet again, ratchet again. How do you stop muscle contraction then? How do you stop muscle contraction? Or keep contracting? How do you stop that muscle from contracting? Well, what causes it to contract? Having calcium around, right? And the ATP around. So if we don't have the calcium around, how do we stop the calcium? Well, we stop the calcium by not letting it come out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? And how do we stop that? Well, we don't depolarize the membrane. How do we stop that? Well, we don't have synaptic transmission anymore. So stop the nerve from firing, don't release the acetylcholine, and now we're not depolarizing that membrane, and we're not relating, you know, not coming down and opening up these channels. But that means you've got to get that calcium out of there. How do you get the calcium out of the cytoplasm of that muscle cell? Well, the sarcoplasmic reticulum has these calcium pumps, and they work very well. They pump that calcium right back up into the sarcoplasmic reticulum very fast. And if you want to look at muscle that can contract fast versus muscle that can't contract fast, it's related to the number of pumps, the density of pumps on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So muscle, a sarcoplasmic reticulum that has a lot of pumps can actually relax a lot quicker, which means what? You can have another contraction a lot quicker. So the rate of being able to contract back and forth really fast is related to, actually, some of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the density of the pumps that are inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum, to drop that calcium down again so you don't go into tetany, all right? And so you can actually relax, contract again. But the myosin ATPase has to be fast enough, too, to keep up with all this, right? So together, think of the ATPase being fast enough to be able to keep up with it, but also to get that calcium levels down fast enough so you can have relaxation and contraction again. Now, what time are we supposed to leave here? 10:30?
9:45.
Is it 9:45? Which means now, right? Okay. So, so let's continue with some of that next time, and we'll pick that up, and we'll get these PowerPoints online, and we have Echo as well as a podcast for this. 1 hour and 5 minutes. Sorry that I've gone over. You just have to yell at me.